And welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Phil Brynan. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Jazz. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. That was another enjoyable session, I thought.
Yeah, GDPR radio. We covered a lot of ground, to be fair. There was a lot around AI, around breaches. That was a big one. The Online Safety Act as well. I really enjoyed that part of it, to be fair. Just in the interplay between the Online Safety Act and data protection legislation. What was your favourite bit, Phil? What was your highlight?
I don't know. We talked quite a bit about a variety of breaches, didn't we? And we talked about, you know, some credential stuffing breaches and some Citrix bug breaches. So different routes in. That was quite interesting. We talked a bit about the ICO's advice to the housing sector, which I wasn't aware of, so thank you for raising that. That was, again, really interesting to read that. And what interested me most about it was that the ICO did a report on the social housing sector, I think it was 2008. Same thing is coming up 15 years later.
And it's one of those things as well, the blog, it highlights where the issues are, but, and to be fair, it does cross-reference its guidance and how you can, you know, tackle those issues. But obviously, if they've done that in the past and we're in the same situation, what are the next steps after that? Maybe the housing code of conduct.
I don't know. I said something on my mind, and I've now come back to what I was going to say then. But I was just talking about the. I was going to link it back to say about the kind of reprimands rather than fines, and you know how that potentially doesn't encourage everyone to move along, does it? It maybe encourages people to drag their feet. But yeah, we had a good session. I think, you know, we had quite a lot of bit of interaction. But that was, I think, my highlights were all the different types of breaches: spear phishing, credential stuffing, you know, Citrix bugs, not patching stuff. You know, the things that I would say or could say are obvious stuff. And then that discussion we had about the ICO's guidance, was it this week or last week to the housing industry?
Yeah, this week. I found it really interesting as well. What's that nuclear waste site called again?
Sellafield.
I was gonna say Seinfeld then. Sellafield. Yeah. So they've been under fire.
As reported in the Guardian. Yes.
Yeah. That just came to me. I didn't even think that one through. but yeah, so they've been subject to a lot of cyber attacks, supposedly, which they've been covering up for a few years. And, you know, now they're asking, OK, well, where's the evidence of that? Which I found quite humorous. Yeah.
It was good having a quick touch on AI again. AI is like everywhere, always. But the new, almost like the new generation. So in the last 12 months, we've had you all know better than any of us, Miles. GPT-3, 3.5, and 4. We've got Bard. We've now got this new Google. This is all within 12 months, isn't it? New versions, yeah. New iterations, more powerful.
Just where is it going to go from here? You know, it's not slowing down.
No, it's not. No.
Well, without further ado, I think we should let the listeners go into the main part of the session before we cover everything as usual in the intro.
Excellent. Good stuff.
So we hope you all enjoy the session and thanks for joining me, Phil. It's been a good one. This session is recorded. If you've got any problems with that, there's a privacy notice on screen and just let us know after the session. And without further ado, let's get started. So how's your week been, Phil?
It's been mixed, to be honest, Jasmine. I've been good. It's been good. I've had 2 days of doing PCIDSS assessments with Ken A for a customer. So Monday was on-site interviewing. Well, Ken A was leading it, so I was really riding shotgun. She was a lead auditor. But on Tuesday, went to a data center in Manchester, which is in an old gold bullion vault, bank vault, a couple of stories underground in Manchester, which is fascinating because there's still this massive, enormous steel door. The data center, the actual data server racks are all in the old vault. So it's a massive door. To get in there, and they have this piece of concrete. It's about that thick. They said the walls are a meter thick concrete laced with steel ball bearings, so that it's much harder to drill through it. But it's quite an interesting site, you know, and there's a what we call it, you know, a man trap, where you've got to go through one gate and then close that gate when you go through the other gate to get through. So it's very, it seems very secure. We go, been there three or four times every year. We have to go and inspect this data center. Last year when we went, they'd had a power outage the weekend, and everything was switched off. It was a disaster zone.
So could you get locked in then?
No, you get locked out. Basically, all the magnetic locks all kind of release. So it's not a question of being locked in. It's like anyone can get in if you're not careful. But it's very discreet where this place is. There's no signage. It's just, you know, it's just like this brown door. You just go down these flights of stairs. It's quite interesting.
Was you planning your heist then?
No. Anyway, so that was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday was catching up, Thursday was catching up, and then today's been, as I say, TIA, DPA, and podcast prep.
Very nice.
What about you? What have you been up to?
It's been a mixed bag, really. I've been helping customers starting the compliance journey, which is always fun on our side, but it might not be the same for the customer when they know what's ahead of them. So I've been on with that. I've been catching up with customers that I've not spoken to in a little while, which is really nice. I think everyone's just so busy before, you know, clearing up before Christmas.
Trying to get finished up. Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because people are going away or not, but there's been so many sales coming in this week. I'm sure if Laura's listening, if she's got time, she can vouch for that. We got four in yesterday. That's just me alone. So, it's been a lot, but can't complain.
Can't complain. Busy, busy.
Yeah. So what have you seen in the news?
There's been quite a lot, I think, this week, actually. And I've been kind of going back over a couple of weeks. I mean, the thing that seems to be a lot of chat about, actually, I have to say I've not read it all because there's so much of it, is about cookies and Meta and EU and, so there's a lot of stuff about that.
Yeah, week in, week out at the minute, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's updates on all sorts of, a lot of breaches. I don't know where you want to start with all this stuff, but there was a lot of breaches this week. Obviously, the digital Data Protection Digital Information Bill has progressed through to the Lords now as well, and there's been some reports of looking at that. And then some other interesting bits of news. I found a couple of interesting reports to have a look through and read. I downloaded some of those to read, and there's been a lot. What about you? What have you seen?
That was a nice little flavour of the session.
Everyone's going to get off now. There's nothing on there that's going to be interesting.
No, luckily for me anyway, you didn't go into too much detail. Otherwise, I think we'd be a bit stumped. But I saw, to be fair, that the ICO has warned against people losing trust in AI in the next year. I think, as you know, the use of AI in business operations increases, I think governance obviously needs to follow with that. But it's just making sure that people are, or organizations are, considering the governance around it, the security around it, rather than just getting too excited and
why do they think lose trust? What do they mean by that? You know, losing trust.
I was intrigued
in
by this because I think there's two ways to think about it, really. You know, obviously there is that fear of the unknown, and what, you know, I think already there might be a lack of trust in organizations' use of people's information, you know, just due to a lack of understanding of how people's personal data can be lawfully used. People complain about, you know, not having their consent for certain things, and it could partly be down to that. Especially with AI being, mind-boggling technology.
I guess it depends what the AI is being used for. I mean, we're looking at AI. We're testing various models with inbound cases. Anyway, obviously, the key thing is security. And we're not at all comfortable with the idea of putting customer data up into some kind of large language model. So anything we put up there, we've got 10 test cases we've stripped all the customer information out of and anything like that, and we've been putting it into different engines to see how well it responds, and I have to say that they're not very good at all. They're good with the simple stuff, like, you know, if you say to ChatGPT, for instance, you know, write me a typical record of person activity for an IT department, it'll do a really good job, actually. But right. if you put in a more complex query, you know, the type of real life stuff that happens, you know, what do you think about this ChatGPT? It's not very good at all.
Yeah, I've tried that in the past. And I've probably mentioned it on this a couple of times now, to be fair. It was saying that biographic information, so, you know, you've got like a bio on I don't know, a website, that can be special category data, as well as a photo. In any instance, it wasn't, you know, if health data is included or this and that. And so I think it's just reiterating to, you know, to people that don't rely on ChatGPT for your answers, because it is a risk in itself.
It is. I mean, our preference is to use, which we are trialing as well, the AI model within our own Salesforce CRM system. So therefore, you know, it would be referencing our IP, looking at our case history, looking at our white papers and guidance notes and blogs and everything that we load up into our CRM system, which is there anyway. And therefore it doesn't put the data out of our environment. It keeps it all within the CRM. And that's my preference, but that's the most expensive way of doing it. But, you know, it gives you a lot more control over it, and you're not just looking at, you know, what's out there on the internet. You're looking at what content we've curated and we've written and that we're confident in. So we're just waiting to get a proper trial. We keep having meetings with Salesforce about this. In fact, I went to see them in Ireland about it a couple of weeks ago. And we're just waiting to try and get a proper trial. So all the demos are very contrived, you know, oh, you've got a solar panel, you know, it's broken, have a go with the chatbot. Well, the chatbot's pretty good at that kind of stuff. You ask it about, you know, does this privacy policy cover this type of processing activity? It's like, you know, they're no good at all at the moment are doing that. But it's all been proven, because Google have announced a new thing, haven't they? Is it Gemini AI?
Yeah. So funnily enough, I only heard about Bard, the chatbot Bard, Google Bard or something like that, a couple of weeks ago. Apparently that came out earlier this year, and now they've got a new one, Gemini, that's supposed to be an improvement on that. Apparently
Bard famously got something wrong on its own publicity launch, didn't it?
Yeah. So
what's your name? Fred. No, that's not right.
So we'll see how this one goes. It's funny because I was looking into this, so Gemini is supposed to be it's supposed to consider its responses much more carefully than Bard, but even still, that doesn't instill trust in for me in Gemini, because we are still in early days of AI in general, really, and these language models. Funnily enough, I lost my phone last week at a bar at my big age. So I got it back last night. But in the meantime, I bought just a really cheap phone that can, you know, send text, calls, connect to the internet if I need to. So it didn't have 4G on it. It was a touch screen. You know those?
It didn't have 4G on it?
No. What, so it was slow. It had 3G.
Did it?
Yeah, just about. That exactly. Crikey. So it was barely working. But so the phone is 10 years old, and it literally took me back in time to 2013. It was a touchscreen phone, and I remember having one, you know, when I was about 10 years ago or something, and thinking that it was just amazing, and this technology was, you know, I've never seen anything like it. And then you look back at this phone now, and I just wanted to throw it at a wall most of the time, because it was so behind.
It probably damaged the wall, actually. They were quite robust then, weren't they?
Yeah, its battery life is doing pretty well compared to iPhones these days. But that we'll be in that same situation in 10 years with AI. You know, things will move on so massively.
I distinctly remember 3G getting launched, because I was working at Leeds United at the time, and we supplied footage for the very first global trial of 3G, which was on the Isle of Man. So we had a partnership with BT, and we supplied some footage for them to use in their 3G trials. which was Isle of Man and Japan were the first places working on 3G. Anyway, we then did a deal with Three, and we got these 3G phones, which you couldn't use at all. But mine was like a big burger. It's like a burger clamshell phone thing, which is quite. So I remember it quite distinctly, actually, when it all came, 3G came into effect.
Yeah.
But I read something. There was a guy writing, I think, a Ropes and Gray law practice. He was basically saying that he's had lots of, this guy called Edward Mackin, he's had about 20 different updated privacy notices in the last couple of weeks. So he's kind of saying, you know, there's an upsurge in privacy notices being refreshed and republicized. And the two key things that are being updated are the use of AI, either current use of AI or envisaged use of AI, and references to the data privacy framework, which I thought was quite interesting. He goes on to say, you know, how often do you review your privacy notices? You know, it should be an annual exercise. And how often do we see them where they haven't been updated since 2018? You know, it's
so often.
Yeah, processing does change, you know, and it's probably worth refreshing them.
Yeah,
but that was quite interesting.
Same with the ropers, you know, as well.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of people using AI, and they're it's just back to this trust thing there. I don't know if people don't trust the use of the data or whether they don't trust a response. Probably the former, isn't it? Don't really trust what's going on with the data.
What do you mean by response?
Well, you know, you put something in and you get an answer, and is it right or is it wrong?
Yeah, but that's one type of AI, isn't it? That's the language model.
I think
if organizations are using it for other purposes that go over my head, then
during airplanes.
I think that is the future AI airplanes. I think it comes back down to that lack of trust in the organisation to appropriately use your data. You know, it's that fear of the unknown, I suppose. You know, like you're saying here with privacy information, that transparency is vital to maintain or improve trust in its use.
But it's here and it's there, and it's, you know, I think we did a session on it a few weeks ago, didn't we, like 9 different types of AI, like robotics, as well as this kind of large language models. And there's, you know, the whole range of different scenarios, neural linguistic programming, also I can't remember them all top of my head, synaptic models. But it's just getting better, isn't it? It's going to get better.
Yeah.
And if you imagine, you know, I read something about quantum computing last week as well, and kind of potentially a barrier that's been hit with it. But if you imagine that quantum computing, you know, becomes much more established, then that's faster processing, therefore quicker decisions, more capacity to take in more data. It's just going in one direction, isn't it?
Absolutely. Nice to, it's exciting to watch the ride, really. Sit back and watch the ride.
yeah, you know, it's a good time. I mean,
yeah.
It's going to affect everything,
yeah.
You know, everything that we do.
Although I do feel like the older I get now, the more I understand, say, like my grandparents who refuse to stay ahead of the times and come and or constantly relate to back in their day.
He constantly refuses to stay up the times.
Yeah, that's true, to be fair. He's an old man at heart.
He always says that, doesn't he?
Bashing him today, but it's nothing he would say to his face. but yeah, like the way things are changing now, that the growth trajectory of technology is just scary. I feel like when I'm my grandparents' age, I hope you appreciate, Phil, I'm not referring to your generation, because I feel like I'm choosing my words carefully.
I don't think you are referring to my generation. Thank
that's
you very
good,
much.
That's good. Just wanted to put that out there. I think that the way things are going, I'm not even going to recognise the world from what it was when I grew up. That kind of scares me a little bit, but it's also very exciting. If we've got robots delivering us, or even robot chefs. Sorry, I'm going off a little bit now, but that will be
it's inevitable.
Anyway, what else have we seen in the news? So
there's been quite a lot in the news. I was going to say there was carry on, because I was going to say something then about what you were just talking about, but I can't remember what it was. It's
about robot chefs.
Calendar-like brain. No, slightly before that, but it might come back to me. Carry on.
Okay. So I was in that Meta have launched end-to-end encryption on Messenger and Facebook. It's not being rolled out to Instagram yet, but that might happen in the future. I found this really interesting because it seems to I guess, go against the recent Online Safety Act, which, you know, there were calls by the government and by Parliament for Meta to not implement end-to-end encryption due to concerns around child safety online. Well, they've done it anyway. I'm not sure how this will fare.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? So, you know, the law is saying implement a suitable, appropriate technical and organisational measures to protect data, you know, in transit as well as, oh, I've seen those at the an airport, those burger delivery robots.
I want to know what that airport is.
I've only flown to, oh, Milan. It was in Milan. Went to Milan in October to the PCI thing. And yeah, there. And I mean, but they look very easy to hijack. You can stand next to one and take the food off it if you want. So, but there's interest. So yeah, well, there's a requirement to introduce technical and organizational measures, isn't there? To protect your customers, but then the authorities want to be able to snoop. And then there is this kind of other angle, which is, you know, well, it's not just snooping, it's child safety and other, you know, safety measures that need to be considered as well. And there's definitely a kind of at least three-way tension there, isn't there? You know, is Meta right to encrypt the data to protect the majority of transmissions or all transmissions, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a step forward.
Dinosaur chef.
It seems to be a step forward, you know, for protecting people's privacy. But I don't know. I think it's more the concerns with the Online Safety Act that, you know, around data protection. But at the same time, it's a way up, isn't it, of child safety. And then, like you say, to protect a small amount that might need that protection and the greater public. It's...
Yeah, but I mean, because it's encrypted data, obviously it can be decrypted, can't it? Now, I don't know whether there's kind of there's cryptographic keys at both ends and nobody's got the ability to unlock or decrypt the data unless they're at either of those two ends. I don't know how it works, but it might be the case that it's possible for the authorities, if they want to ask for the data decrypted, which is kind of a safety mechanism, isn't it? Safety valve.
Yeah, I think that's the approach. But then what's the threshold for that? What's the trigger point?
Well, if the data DPDI bill goes through, low. Yeah. Even lower, sorry.
No, that's true. Yeah,
and I don't know the other stuff. I was reading something about facial recognition, the police using mobile facial recognition as well. And there's this 94-year-old chap that's been a protester since 1948, you know, political protester. And he's not got any criminal convictions or anything. But yet he's on this database of extremists and being put on that database. So, you know, there's other considerations to safeguard people as well. You know, it's not. Is it right that he's on that database just because he attends your, you know, protest?
Is it also he's rightly so on that list?
He's on this list because he's been, you know, to some of these protests, and the police have put him on this database of extremists. He only knows because he did a subject tax request in 2013 and found he was on it. So. You know, if you're able to interpret, you know, intercept messages and open them and read them and then compile, you know, these blacklists of people, that doesn't feel right, does it? It's not a particularly democratic way of working.
And then there's those issues around discrimination again as well. I read that with in relation to the is it an app, did you say?
Yeah, it's an app called iPatrol, and it's an app you put onto a phone. The police put it onto a phone, they can basically scan your phone. It's been trialed by South Wales, Gwent and Cheshire police forces, and they've used it like about 42 times, but they've used it for identifying dead bodies as well, which is a bit bizarre, you know, a bit macabre, isn't it? So yeah, the police have got, some officers have got this on their phone, and they can take a photograph of you, and then it checks with a national database, does a match and comes back to tell them if you're wanted for any allegations of offences in other force areas.
I wonder if Clearview AI will have anything to do with that at some point.
Don't know.
Yeah. In relation to, well, the Online Safety Act and Ofcom, so I also read that Ofcom has published age verification guidelines for porn sites. thickness was raised as an issue a few months ago, unless that was, that could have been to do with cookies as well. But the guidance requires that sites implement reliable age verification measures using either age estimation, age verification, or a combination of both. So such age verification measures might include open banking, photo ID matching, facial age estimation, mobile network operator age checks, credit card checks, and digital identity wallets. Yeah, so there are some concerns around potentially sensitive personal data being breached, collected, shared, or sold, especially with these sites. You know, there's been concerns in the past, they've been in the news. I think we had a conversation about it a few months back now, around data protection measures, like I just said, with cookies. And, you know, we're talking about trust. There's the trust that they'll hold your information appropriately. Who knows? I read that Abigail.
It's also. Carry on. Sorry.
No, go on.
No. I was going to say that, you know, we countless times you're reading about third parties that have been, you know, hacked and breached, like 23 and me. We're not got into the breaches discussions yet because there's been a lot, haven't there? But, you know, that would suggest that there's going to be an industry for age verification suppliers. And, you know, that's all third party data. And you know, the evidence would suggest and track record suggests that these places are going to get compromised at some point. That data is going to get in the public domain.
Yeah, it's funny when I was reading this. So Abigail Burke, she's a program manager for Platform Power and Open Rights Group. She's, you know, displayed her concerns with the ICO, saying that it's proven to be one of the weakest data regulators in Europe and is in urgent need of reform. So I'm glad it's not just us having some of these opinions. God,
it's been like that for, well, decades. I mean, I think in 2011 there was a survey of the supervisory authorities, and Britain was voted 21st out of 27 member states, so right down the bottom, you know, one of the least effective. And Viviane Reding, who was the Commissioner for Justice for the EU, again back in 2011, was when the fines, maximum fine was £500, was saying, you know, you're basically like having a guard dog tied up in your basement. That's how she compared the UK, the ICO. She said it's like having a guard dog tied up in the basement. It's absolutely ineffective.
Well, that's I like
so,
that
so it's not a new theme. It's not a new theme.
Yeah. Here, Burke called on Ofcom to go further by setting clearer standards and guidelines to ensure users' data will be protected from the substantially increased risk of fraud and cybercrime that comes with invasive age verification technologies. I suppose while she's putting the onus on Ofcom rather than the ICO, it's a smart move due to the bite of the guard dog.
or lack of it. It's been to the dentist.
Exactly.
And teeth filed down.
Speaking of the ICO, so we touched a little bit last week before you arrived, Phil. Can I just say, how quick is it since last week's episode?
I know, yeah.
I feel like we were talking to Ollie 2 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we spoke a little bit about the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill going into its next stage in the House of Lords. So there were about, was it 240 pages of amendments made?
The day before the presentation. I mean, do you think that's skullduggery and sly moves trying to just, you know,
absolutely,
or do you think that's incompetence and inefficiency?
Well, maybe a bit of both, to be fair, but it was Labour called for it to go through the committee stage again, which was rejected. You know, there were concerns that all of these amends, they were supposed to be minor technical amends, I believe, or something like that. Instead, there was, you know, big changes added. It's hard, like you were saying earlier, Phil, it's hard to actually digest the amends due to just the scale of it and the way it's written.
Well, the way they're structured as well, you know, they're just, it's really bitty, isn't it? When you look at the 248 pages, and it's just really, really, really bitty. It's saying amend this, you have to refer to the law. Oh yeah, that's what it says, and amend it to that. All right, well, that's what it would be if it was amended. It's just a very I think, slow process of trying to get your head around what those changes are. I mean, there are some summaries, one of which is the Public Law Project have published a summary report, but they only pick up on three or four things as being issues, you know, subject access requests saying is an issue, which is quite interesting because they're saying, you know, what you're watering down the ability of data subjects to access that information in the DPDI bill, because you're changing from manifestly unfounded and excessive to being vexatious or excessive, which they say is a lower threshold, which it probably is. And the government's response is, no, we're not doing that at all. But then this report is saying, on the one hand, they're saying, you know, we're not undermining people's rights or watering down people's rights. On the other hand, they're saying, but it's going to save, I don't know, billions of pounds, primarily through less red tape. And it, according to this report, the government's saying, especially through subject access requests. Mm. You know, so how can there possibly be a cost saving without there being an impact on the response, you know, basically knocking back people's rights? The two things just seem to be incongruous, really. You know, but
yeah.
So they highlight that. They also highlight the watering down of data protection impact assessments and the kind of effective, reversal of the protections against solely automated decision making, where it becomes the norm unless it's an exception, rather than it being not the norm unless it's an exception. And then there's a couple of other changes. One of which is the ICO becoming less independent or not independent at all, because a lot of the recommendations, the guidance has to be approved by the Secretary of State. So not really independent at all.
What I find ridiculous on that point is in the creation of the data privacy framework, I swear this was one of the biggest issues with the US that, you know, stopped them from actually achieving adequacy.
Yeah.
So how are we moving towards that while being assured that adequacy would still be intact? It's not going to happen, surely, or not at least easily. It depends. I don't know. It's just stupid. It's just absolutely stupid. I just don't understand where any common sense has come into play here. I'm thinking of something else there, to be fair. Ollie was saying last week that there was a general feeling of being proud of the legislation, but it's not relating to this bill. It was relating to the GDPR, I think, at the IAPP conference. So
yeah, well, that's interesting because I read something about the conference and the kind of the review. It's 5 years in, you know, how is it doing? And some people were saying it's not doing very well at all. It needs to be GDPR 2, it needs reforming. But the general consensus, I think there's a report due out next year about how effective the GDPR is. But what it seems to be saying is it's the cornerstone of lots of different pieces of legislation. So, you know, those bits of legislation lean on it, leverage it and spring off from it. But it's quite interesting. Again, I don't know what everyone's thoughts are, whether it, you know, it has been effective, is effective, you know, is fit for purpose for the next 5 years. You know, it's amazing how fast 5 years has gone, really, to be honest.
Mm. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that I quite like the fact that, see, what people don't like about it, one of the things people don't like about it is that it is woolly and open interpretation in some areas. And that's one of the features I like about it, because it means that we can use it, you know, as bit in different scenarios. If it becomes more rigid or, you know, that makes it more difficult, or if it becomes even less woolly, then even more woolly, then that might make it, you know, less effective because it could people more wriggle room. But I don't think there's that much that's, I mean, some of it's hard work, like ROPAs. Someone said here on the ROPAs, you know, ROPAs are just hard work to put together and maintain. But, you know, without them, you know, how do you know what's going on? How are you controlling what's going on? So they're kind of a necessary evil, in my opinion. But, you know, others take a different view. You know, but I quite like the fact that it is open to interpretation and we do have some guidance. But, you know, you have got a bit of wiggle room.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
It's a really hard question, I think, that I've obviously asked you. But I think it's the issue probably isn't with the legislation itself, but the way it's enforced. And we talk about this all the time. But, you know, you get organisations that are either, you know, hit all of a sudden with a scare that they've not got anything in place and it's a risk and it can cause these fines and etc. And then it's a massive effort to bring yourself up to a level of compliance But if you've got all these things in place from the start and it works really well, then it does work. Otherwise, if you don't, you know, on the third hand, if you've been getting away with not having anything in place this long and you continue to, then you won't see it as effective and you'll work around it. And it brings negative connotations.
Yeah, I mean, people do want certainty, don't they? So going back to what sort of started off, where I was this morning doing this, reviewing this teacher transfer impact assessment and the data protection impact assessment, in my view, they weren't good enough. In my view, they weren't critical enough. In my view, they didn't answer or address all the questions that they should do. You know, the TIA was done on a form that isn't a standard form published by the ICAO or the European Data Protection Board. So in my view, it needs further work. But in the customer's view, it might be perfectly adequate. The thing is, you don't know unless you get into trouble. And then you present your TIA and your DPA to the ICAO and they say, nah, that's no good. You know, oh, right, okay, well, we could have done with a bit more certainty in the first place. I tell you what, I looked at the ICAO's website this morning to get their TIA template. And the TIA, the International Transfers page said last updated 6th of December, 2023. I thought, oh my God, what's changed on it? Anyway, I've emailed the ICAO, not John Edwards, but the case supporter, saying, you know, why can't you just put a summary of the changes on there? You know, I now have to read the whole section and I find that nothing's changed of material importance, you know, but it's just, they're not very helpful, are they? With, you know, we've updated it, you know, well, what have you changed? Give us a clue.
Although I did see, which might be helpful to the housing sector, that they've offered some advice. So they produced a blog saying that they received a number of complaints from residents who have been failed by poor data protection practices. So they've offered some guidance on common issues that they see in the housing sector.
Where is this then? I didn't see this. Is it on the ICAO's website?
Yeah, it's on the ICAO's website. Let me see if I've still I've got the link here. I'll put it in the chat. Let me just make sure that's the right one. Yeah. So they highlighted common issues, including inappropriate disclosures of personal data, data protection law as a framework for responsible sharing, and failure to keep accurate records. So inappropriate disclosures is just not considering whether it's necessary or appropriate to disclose data. And, you know, that can cause issues in itself when SARs are undertaken and you know, you can see that. You can see that your data has been shared inappropriately. Data protection law is a framework for responsible sharing. So I found a really interesting point here that they've stated it's not a barrier to sharing information to support residents when this is needed. And I see that attitude often, you know, GDPR and data protection legislation as a barrier rather than an enabler. You know, if you think about your information, you want that to be protected by an organization that's holding it, and the GDPR enables that organization to use it appropriately rather than having to protect that solely and which might end up being a hindrance to yourself. And I think it's just that attitude towards it that needs changing in some situations, that, you know, that can be changed through bringing it back down to real life.
Yeah. And I didn't see that. That's really quite interesting. I mean, that's funny because when was this published? Because there's been a kind of, we started working on a code of conduct for housing a couple of years ago with the National Housing Federation and a couple of housing associations. But it kind of, we got to the point of consulting with the ICAO's team on it, and they were very supportive, but they picked so many loads and loads of questions on some things. They're saying, oh, you're not detailed enough there, and other things they're saying, oh, you're far too prescriptive here. And in the end, we thought, this is just hard work, the whole team, that we'll just park it. Anyway, we sat there for probably 18 months, but this week everyone's come back onto the chat saying, oh, we need to get the housing code of conduct metric again in the new year. So maybe it's a result of some of this, I don't know. But anyway, we're going to get the housing code of conduct back on to have a look at it again in January and see if it's still right to have, if it's still needed, and what it should contain. But the ICAO did a report into social housing in 2008, and I'm, you know, it's the same things coming up now as it was then. It's interesting.
I don't know, I think you put in the notes, Phil, that so the Supreme Court have ruled that a lack of resources is not enough reason to avoid a housing duty.
Yeah, that's not so much about data protection. That was about providing adaptations to housing for a disabled resident in London, Croydon, I think it was.
All right.
So anyway, it went through the Court of Appeal, and you know, the Court of Appeal has said, you know, you've effectively haven't shown us enough evidence to suggest that you're under resourced and can't do this. So, you know, you got to do it, basically.
Well,
but it wasn't to do with data, it was to do with provision of housing.
Yeah, I suppose that's, you know, it's a good move in preventing opening of the floodgates for other councils to rely on, you know, lack of resources as a reason. But also, what are they supposed to do if they do actually have that lack of resource? I know they're so strained at the minute, you know, due to housing prices and budget cuts.
The resource in this case was appropriate housing with appropriate adaptations. Apparently, you know, the person who complained was a wheelchair user and couldn't reach the cupboards, couldn't reach the cooker, couldn't reach the facilities. So that was the kind of resourcing issue rather than human resources. But I mean, you might be able to apply the same kind of logic.
Well, anyway.
So there you go.
So there's been quite a lot recently about breaches as well, hasn't there?
Well, there's been quite a lot of breaches, haven't there? I mean,
yeah.
I saw that Russian hackers apparently have used spear phishing to steal information from politicians and government officials and other places. So, you know, and this isn't just, doesn't appear to be just hearsay, because the Russian ambassador was called to answer these charges, and a number of different people have been sanctioned. So this doesn't seem to be just a news story. This seems to be actually something that I knowledge has happened.
Wow.
Now, David Cameron has said, despite Russia's attempts to interfere in UK politics, Russia's attempts to interfere in UK politics are completely unacceptable and seek to threaten our democratic process. But despite their repeated efforts, they have failed. I'm not sure whether I believe that. But I mean,
yeah.
They don't have to necessarily try that hard, do they? Because, again, there's more exposure of personal data by a NHS Foundation Trust in Cambridge reported this week as well. So again, this is back down to like those police ones where they've put information responding to freedom information requests, you know, online, and you know, it's got all sorts of data behind the scenes, probably in other sheets or hidden columns and things like that. So you don't necessarily need to be a top-notch hacker to get hold of this information, because we're doing a pretty good job of putting it out there in the public domain ourselves by accident.
Yeah, going back to that first case, so Dave, Hendry and I had a call with
Dave, my mate Dave, as in Cameron, but no, you were talking Hendry.
Definitely right. Not my mate.
Right.
It's really weird, actually, because I'm just looking out and I can see my stepdad Dave just in the garden. It threw me off. We was on a call with a partner, and they were showing us through their software. It's a security training platform, and they're showing us through their software where, you know, you can send out phishing exercises to your staff just to make sure that they're complying with or that they don't fall for it, essentially. And even their examples of email templates, they look so realistic that it's scary. It made me think, you know, the booking.com breach recently. Was that spear phishing?
I can't remember. It might have been credential stuffing. I can't remember. I think it was credential stuffing, but I might be wrong.
All right.
I think so.
We'll
come on to that in a second. I mean, Sean raises an interesting point about in the chat about these no win, no fee solicitors and so on and so forth. So one of the things I noticed in the news was that in Europe, the Advocate General, who is, the courts don't have to follow the Advocate General's advice, but they often do, has basically said that damages can be awarded for data breaches despite there being no harm. which is, of course, is complete opposite to what how the courts have ruled in the UK. You know, without we talked about this a few, probably 8 months ago. You know, without there being this de minimis principle, you know, without there being evidence of harm, then you can't claim compensation. So, you know, if you were a housing association in Ireland, for instance, or somewhere, and, you know, you've got these no in, no fees lists coming in, there's been a data breach, then in theory, you know, you're good for compensation, despite there being no harm, just the fact there has been a data breach. But in the UK, of course, that's not the, the position. But
yeah, I feel like since the decision of, was it Lloyd v. Google that decided that?
No, Lloyd v. No, it was.
Was that distress?
Can't remember.
Was that distress can't, needs, it can't, it needs to be more than trivial.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't that one. It was fairly recently. I can't remember. I'd have to double check, to be honest.
Right. Yeah, I think. Well, anyway, since this legislation, I don't know if I can vouch for everyone else in the team, but me personally, I haven't seen as many compensation claims on the back of data breaches. You know. To.
No, I think that's because of the attitudes of the courts that, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is yeah.
So this, you know, this could take a, like you say, Sean, the no win, no fee. It could take that kind of direction again.
Yeah. I mean, what they seem to be doing is putting in SARS to get information for other, you know, litigious purposes like disrepair claims and so on and so forth. But again, the law currently doesn't preclude that approach, does it? But, I mean, going back to these spear phishing attacks, I mean, as I said when I was at this PCI conference in Ireland in October, you know, the hackers and the criminals go to enormous lengths to prepare themselves for these kind of attacks. You know, some of them are kind of like drive by, you know, oh, there's a bot that's found their own website and in it goes. But a lot of this kind of all the spear phishing and these coordinated attacks are well prepared. You know, the saying and the thing I read that. That you know the malicious actors are impersonating, you know, people, and, you know, very credibly, like you say, with email addresses and websites and links that look, you know, legitimate, but they're not. And everyone's moving at such a fast pace these days, aren't they? You know, like click 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 click, emails coming in, get them turned down. To, you know, human error is bound to be mistakes,
especially on a Friday afternoon.
Especially when you lose your phone in a bar.
Yeah. Anyway, Sean said in the chat that a group of capital workers put a joint claim in for a data breach they suffered, as it appears to have fallen at the first hurdle.
Yeah, no surprise. Yeah. I also saw that, according to The Guardian, Sellafield has been subject to cyber attack, which is quite worrying. It's the biggest nuclear waste repository in the world, and they say that the cyber attacks have been ongoing since 2015. Anyway, Sellafield have denied it all, and apparently the regulator for nuclear regulator has said they're going to have a look at it in more detail. But I mean, that's that's a bit worrying, isn't it? You got a facility like that, critical infrastructure. You know, subject to the Network and Information Systems Regulations, one would think, if it's a nuclear waste processing plant, you know, with ropey cybersecurity, allegedly.
Yeah, they've trumped the allegations, haven't they, saying that there's no evidence that's been provided of these breaches, which is ridiculous because they've been accused of covering them up since 2015.
Exactly. But they'll probably invite you on. Come on, have a look then. All our data is stored in that silo over there. Oh, by the way, it's glowing.
Walk towards the light.
Exactly, yeah.
So what are the breaches of the bean?
Well, there's been, did you see that 23andMe is called hack a few October, wasn't it? So this is a company that processes genetic information, and it's used for, you know, things, serious things, as well as law enforcement, etc., as well as tracing ancestry. But this is a database of genetic information. So that got hacked in October, and they seem, again, to death by a thousand cuts. Initially, they said that only 14,000 people, only 14,000 people's information had been compromised. But now they've said, oh, actually, it's about 5.5 million people. But this is genetic information, you know, in a genetic database. Mm. And it's a whole range of things. And what was interesting about this is, one of the things that's interesting about this is that the attack was allegedly through a credential stuffing attack. But some of the users are saying, well, hang on, credential stuffing is where, you know, they found, a combination of username and password on the dark web. And then that's used to batter a load of different, you know, I might fire it at LinkedIn, Booking.com, Salesforce, you know, wherever, Facebook. So if you've got the same combination of username and password that's being compromised and is on the dark web, that couldn't be used to try and, get in legitimately. Multi-factor authentication, obviously a good guard against that, because whilst credentials might be valid, you'll fail at the MFA hurdle. But anyway, what one of these, or few of these people are saying is that they had unique username and password combinations to access 23andMe, so it cannot possibly be a credential stuffing attack. So that was interesting. Anyway, what 23andMe have come back with is saying that, we did a bit of data sharing with a couple of other the suppliers, MyHeritage and some other company to help people with their family trees. And that seems to have been the weakness in their setup, you know. Right. So again, you think you've got something boxed off, you know, you introduce a third party and all of a sudden you've introduced a vulnerability. It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's one of those as well. There's only so much you can do. We talk about due diligence on this a lot, don't we? But I don't know, like, to what extent can you be assured that they will protect your data? I suppose it's a weakness that anyone could be subject to, not specifically that, but weakness in general through some avenue.
Tricky. It's tricky, isn't it? So interesting. And there was also there's been an Adobe vulnerability that's called Cold Fusion that's been around for a while, and that was used in an attack on the US federal servers. So the US Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency have warned about this, and there's been this attack. But again, this is really down to not patching your servers, not patching your hardening your environment. The vulnerability has been known about since 2021. So, you know, there's been several releases and patches to accommodate that. But if you haven't applied the patches to your systems, then you're still running that vulnerability. So again, that was another breach I noticed. And, you know, is it simple mitigation? You know, if you've got a routine and you're testing things and you're doing vulnerability testing and you're doing, you know, your patches, you know, you're hardening your systems and you should be guarding against this kind of stuff. But if you're not doing that, then it's just introducing vulnerabilities, you know, potentially all the time.
Yeah, especially when you've known about it for so long.
Yeah, I mean, it's a chance that, you know, whoever's, you know, in charge of the IT didn't know about it. But if it's a government agency, you'd think that they'd be on top of it, wouldn't you?
You'd think.
And did I do, if you saw, you're not moving house at the moment?
No,
because lots of house purchases got frozen by cyber attack last week, a week before. Again, this is a third party, a company called CTS. They organise a lot of the legal conveyancing for house moves. They got a cyber incident, caused a, you know, outage of their systems, and therefore the whole house move process ground to a halt 24th of November. I don't know if it's freed up and running again, but anybody using that system, and I think they've got 1,700 legal practices using that system for conveyancing, just all kind of stopped.
God. That reminds me of the British Library breach, actually. So there's been further information that's come out about that. So J.K. Rowling's address could be on the dark web. So there's growing concerns, essentially, after the breach, that hackers may have also obtained data relating to public lending, right, which processes payment data, processes payments for the lending of authors' books from UK libraries. So I believe that's from the breach a couple of months ago, that it basically brought them to a halt.
They're still
really
not up. They're still not up and running. I mean, unbelievable. I think it was October. Yeah, I think it was October, but yeah, up and running. This kind of CTS house price thing was a bug in Citrix. Again, it's called a Citrix bleed bug that's been being exploited by a Russian gang in this case. But again, these are all kind of vulnerabilities in software. It's you do your best, don't you? And software maybe lets you down.
Yeah, it seems to be the theme this week, the theme of the breaches recently.
Been,
It's been public sector FOI requests. Obviously, one snuck in here today, but it's going through the motions.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there was quite a lot of breaches this week, I think. One of the proposals in the one of the people in this IAP conference called a guy called Voss. What's his first name? Axel Voss. He's one of these people that's saying the GDPR isn't fit for purpose. You know, there's a lack of harmony and there's slow getting the regulators to work together. He was saying that it should be loosening the whole thing up, you know, and basically saying, you know, do what you want, but don't infringe people's privacy. I'd like to see how that's phrased in the legislation.
Well, that's completely subjective as well. So how can you? I'd love to see how we would expand on that. Surely, you know, that you can't just make a sweeping statement like that and think that that's the solution.
Well, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
So, yeah, anything else you've kind of been on with this week?
This week it's just been stars, really. I've been liaising a lot with our new service manager, Laura. I'm sure we'll get her on a session at some point.
Oh, on a session, definitely, yes.
Yeah. So it's been quite full on. But I think, like I said earlier, it's just that trying to close off as much as I can before Christmas. And I'm sure everybody else is in the same boat, to be honest. But yeah, what about you? Have you got anything coming up next week?
Next week for me, I honestly can't remember. Let me have a quick look. Next week, of course, we've got our Christmas party next Friday afternoon, haven't we? So we'll straight after the podcast, we'll be donning our glad rags and getting ready to go out to the Armouries in Leeds, which will be very nice, won't it?
Looking forward to that. It's come round quick.
Yes, I know. I can't remember what, and I've got little bits on all next week by the looks of it. Which would be interesting, doing lots of bits and pieces, and then they've got another week, and then Christmas.
I know. Have you got any time off over Christmas?
Yeah, I'm gonna have Christmas off. Yeah, the thing I need to do is try and get my head round. So there's been quite a lot of this cookie stuff we talked about. I haven't really fully read it all, but there's also quite a lot of legislation and bills I want to set aside some time to review. Yeah, the EU Data Act and the AI bill, and there's quite a lot of new stuff that's coming down the tracks, all kind of information rights law, you know, our area. So I need to set some time aside, to be honest, which I might be able to do next week, to just plow through some of it and have a quick catch up.
Yeah, it might be worth us doing that together and discussing it on a podcast, to be fair.
We could do.
Quite intense, but
what we're doing next week on the podcast.
So next week is a Christmas special.
Is it?
Yeah,
right, what does that mean? We have to wear funny hats.
I'm sure you've got one, Phil. yeah, it's fancy dress. Grow your beard out a little bit. Go as Santa. Give us a laugh.
I'll do that.
yeah, so it's a Christmas special. So we'll be summing up the year, seeing what Santa's bringing for Christmas. obviously in the world of data protection. And yeah, leaving it broadly open until we get to next Friday, really.
Oh, I see. Now, you're into you like your sports, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You're a sporting kind of a person. So I also read something about the kind of performance improvement technology in elite sports. So, I mean, this has been around for quite some time, but apparently there's been, you know, a bit of an upsurge in it with AI. So, you know, the adoption of bioanalytic services, which are aimed at reducing injury, improving recovery rates, and creating individual insights of athletes' performances, you know, whether they're footballers or racing drivers, or whatever. And then using various equipment for and software for analysing, you know, individual movements. So you've ever seen those running gait machines when you go for posh trainers fitted, they make you run on a treadmill and they film how your feet are falling and that kind of stuff. And then they tailor your trainers accordingly. Well, of course, all that happens, you know, with professional athletes when they get in their footwear. So yeah, there's lots of that. So I just thought you might be interested in that. I mean, all of this stuff, of course, is pushing data out into third party suppliers. Again, you know, what due diligence you're doing on that. But, you know, there's a real clamour to get on top of this stuff because it does potentially give you a competitive advantage, you know, literally on the field of play.
Yeah, You know, it's similar, on a similar note, I suppose, on the topic of AI, at least. Well, I don't know if it's even AI, to be fair. I was having a conversation with Miles a few weeks ago about, I think it's Ray-Bans that have got glasses where you can take pictures through them. Are you aware of them?
No, I wasn't.
I didn't know that they were already a thing. I knew that there were organisations focusing on technology that allows people to read, you know, blind people to read text out loud through the glasses of what's ever in front of them. I don't know how that would work, you know, specifically, but yeah, I found that really fascinating. In terms of the data protection side of the Ray-Bans, you know, what is personal data? Are you collecting personal data of people? And
well, are you a controller?
Exactly.
What can you do with it, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's something to think about. It might be the new era of Ring doorbells.
Yeah. You know, those glasses that sent that text to speech, you know, sound, they found very clever and very useful, don't they?
Yeah. My cousin's working on something like that in South Africa, so we'll see if we can get a little demo.
Yeah, or a free pair, you know, smuggled out off to us for testing purposes. We won't have to read any emails again. I could just sit back and look at them and take them all in.
Just have it running the podcast. Read your notes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, with that, it is the hour mark just about. So thank you, everybody, for joining. Hopefully we'll see you next week for a Christmas special. Steph's, before we finish, Steph's just put in the chat about some Google glasses. So these seem to be quite similar. I'll look into that, actually. It looks really interesting.
The Google glasses are meant to be very good.
From 2014.
In the Ray-Ban were doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like a Black Mirror episode. but yeah, thank you everyone for joining. We hope you have a great weekend and hope to see you next week. And thank you, Phil.
Thank you, Jazz.
My Take care, everyone.
Have a good weekend.